Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to New Books in Children's and Family Literature. I'm host Susan Robb, and today we're talking with Deborah Hopkinson, who is the author of more than 40 books for children. Her newest book's published. Welcome to New Books in Children's and Family Literature. I'm host Susan Robb, and today we're talking with Deborah Hopkinson, who is the author of more than 40 books for children. Her newest book, published by Hyperion, is called The Steamboat School, which is based on a true story. And the book is set in 1847 and is based on the life of Reverend John Barry Meacham. And Deborah, first wanted to thank you for joining me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, it was interesting on this. I mean, there are a number of different questions I have for you about how you decided to go the direction you did with this story. But basically, this is a fictionalized picture book, but it's based on a real story about a school that Meacham started. So tell me where you first heard about this.
Well, actually, this book had a very interesting beginning. The idea originated with Ron Husband, who at the time, and his colleagues, and at the time he was working for Disney as an animator. He was one of the first African-American animators at Disney. And for some reason, a colleague of his had heard about John Barry Meacham and this, who was an entrepreneur and an enslaved person who had earned his own freedom through carpentry, born in Virginia, and then had gone to St. Louis and begun a school and become a minister there. And so I was actually asked to take on the project to help write the story, to go with these amazing illustrations that Ron Husband, who's a legend in his own right, has done for the book.
So it was interesting. With Meacham, one of the things that I noticed was, you know, he was born into slavery, right, in the late 1700s. And then he went on, he really had an impact in the education area, but also as a minister.
Yes, he was born in 1789 in Virginia, and then was really an unusual man. He was very interested in education, and the Tallow Candle School that he started is one of, if not the first schools for both freedmen at the time and enslaved people. And he was also very entrepreneurial, so he was known as someone who would actually purchase enslaved people and have them and train them in his, I think he was a carpenter and also had some other sort of businesses. And then he would then let them earn their freedom and go ahead and pay him back that way. So he was someone who really believed in education, and he actually died before the Civil War in 1854, although his widow, Mary, was arrested for hiding runaway slaves. And in 2001, the Mary Meacham Freedom Crossing became the first site in Missouri to be recognized as part of the National Park Service's National Underground Railroad Network to Freedom. So although he's really an obscure figure today, at the time he was really quite influential both in his ideas and then also in what he did and his actions.
Yeah, and it was amazing when you think about that. What struck me, among other things, was, you know, he first purchased his own freedom, then he purchased his father's, then his wife's. So it was all sort of part of a forward motion thing, which is exemplified in a way in what he did with the school. So the idea of, all right, if the tallow candle school is not going to work because people couldn't come there, then he was just going to take a school someplace where he could run a school. So talk to me about the Steamboat School.
Yeah, so I did go to the Historical Society in St. Louis in the course of researching this book and really wanted to find something that was more substantive about someone who had actually gone there. And according to sort of all the information I could find, one of his students was James Milton Turner, who became a prominent black educator in St. Louis. And so I named the boy in the story James, but it was very clear to me after doing research that I couldn't find enough verifiable historical information to actually tell the story as nonfiction. But in 1847, when the law changed to forbid the kind of school that Reverend Meachin was holding, he had this very ingenious solution of moving the school to the river because he was that was federal property. So that's sort of why it turned out that we did tell it as historical fiction.
And do you know where Ron husband got first heard of the story himself?
No, I have not actually had a chance to meet Ron, but he had a colleague who had heard about John Barry Meacham and had wanted to do something more on him. And so the project came to Hyperion, is of course Hyperion Disney, and so I already had a couple books with them, and so they were looking for a way to make it come, yes, to become a real book, I guess.
So how did you research this? It must have been difficult to research. It sounds like it.
It was, and it was a little disappointing to go and not be able to find really what I wanted. There was a scholar, there is a photo of him, an illustration, I should say, from the State Historical Society of Missouri. I also was able to find something that he had written, which was an address to all the colored citizens of the United States that John Barry Meacham had actually written at the time. But there is a Wikipedia entry on him and a couple of scholars who have studied him. But really, you know, when you're writing nonfiction, and I do write nonfiction as well as fiction, you really need to have more evidence. So we really did. We included everything that we could in the note, but then the story itself and the characters are, and all the dialogue is made up.
Oh, did you find out anything about the Steamboat School itself? I mean, do you know?
No, I was not able to find anything more than sort of what was sort of passed down. He did talk a little bit in this address, which was part of a conference, I believe. He did talk about his background there. So this was a pamphlet, I believe, that he had written. And he does talk about his background there, about being a carpenter and a cooper and purchasing his wife and when he started to preach. But very little is known. So it's very important to me when I do talk to students in schools to be really clear when we're talking about historical fiction as opposed to nonfiction. And although I did want to verify that some of the facts in here, I was not able to.
So I was going to ask you about some of that, because obviously when you come into a book and you've written on many, many topics, including the Titanic, one of my favorites from a long time ago was Clara and the Sweet Freedom Quilt, and you've also written on many different topic areas. So tell me, when you look at a book, do you come into it knowing whether it's going to head into historical fiction or be historical, or does that come later in your research?
I think it really depends on the genre. So I do, for instance, a book like Titanic or my most recent nonfiction book for older readers, which is called Dive, which is about submarines in World War II. It was clearly proposed as a longer work of nonfiction. I think the more difficult areas are areas in picture books where you have a very compressed dramatic arc. So recently, last year, I published a book called Beatrix Potter and the Unfortunate Tale of a Barred Guinea Pig. And it is based on actual entries in Beatrix Potter's journal. But like Steamboat School, in order to make it appealing to a young audience, it is fictionalized and does have an author's note that explains the difference between fiction and nonfiction. And many times I will start out hoping to make a nonfiction book, and an editor will invariably say, you know, there's just not enough story there.
And do you find that isn't more of your things that go to a younger audience? Would it be more likely for that to be historical fiction?
To some degree, I do have a picture book called Annie and Helen, which is about Annie Sullivan and Helen Keller. And it's based on Annie Sullivan's letters about when she first began teaching Helen Keller. And I was very careful there to not include any additional dialogue so any quotes that are there were from her letters. I would say, I don't know, more than half the time, at least, my picture books become historical fiction. Even a book called Sky Boys, How They Built the Empire State Building, is based on, you know, very detailed research into the Empire State Building, and I use it a lot to talk about informational sources, but the characters are imagined. And I think especially nowadays, both as students go from elementary to middle and high school, but also just in our age of internet and confusing sources of information, I always, at author visits in schools, no matter what level, really talk about, for instance, where could I have found this information? And it's not just Google, it's not just a book, but really have them think about, say, for the Empire State Building, to get the details of how many workers and how much steel was used, to think about where, in fact, the source of that had to be. And I will eventually get students to think deeper, I guess, and say, oh, it had to come from a source at the time, either the blueprints or the construction company, which is, in fact, where it came from. So I think that's very important, and I know teachers do that all the time in schools, but when I'm in a school for only a day, it's one of the things that I focus on.
Do you find that kids at different ages are are attracted to history. So when you walk into a classroom of a younger group of kids versus middle school or whatever, what's the tenor there?
Well, I always start out in a big group of asking them, like, what book has kept them up most recently at night. And it's very, very rare that it'll be historical fiction or nonfiction. And, you know, kids tend to read, as adults do for pleasure. A lot of middle schoolers read a lot of dystopian and fantasy. But I also will have sort of history nuts at all levels. And it's always fun to have. I know that there are students there who remember more about Titanic than I now can remember myself. And I'm writing my third book on World War II, and there are definitely, and sometimes they do tend to be boys, but not always. But who know things that I don't know? You know, those kids that have that curiosity to dive really deeply into a topic, whether it's baseball or dinosaurs or World War II or Titanic.
Have any of your books come out of questions kids have asked about a topic?
Actually, the Titanic book did. It came out in 2012 for the 100th anniversary, but in going to schools, you know, that's a topic that kids, it's endlessly fascinating, I think, to both adults and children. And I would have kids say, are you ever going to write a book about the Titanic? The other question I get a lot, which is not a topic that I will write about, though, is I get lots of kids that say, will you write about 9/11?
Wow. Huh. It's interesting.
And I think that's because that is in recent enough history, although many of the kids that I talked to, you know, weren't born then. But still, it has that feeling. I have written one picture book about World War I, but World War II seems to be a topic also of great interest from elementary through middle school, I think.
Now, one of the things I had read is that you have said that part of the challenge is as educators, parents, and librarians, is to bring history to kids in a way that shows them that it's exciting. So what do you think about when you write?
Well, many of my topics, whether it's historical fiction or nonfiction, I'm always, I think, motivated by this feeling like, wow, how come I didn't know this myself? And so one of the books I love to talk about to students in schools is The Great Trouble, which is about the 1854 cholera epidemic, and which I wrote after reading Stephen Johnson's The Ghost Map. And it's about Dr. John Snow, who is the founder of epidemiology and public health. And I just never get tired of sort of unraveling that story and having students look at an actual death certificate and at cholera bacteria and thinking about sort of what had to go into the mystery of trying to figure out the cause of a disease when you didn't have a microscope powerful enough to actually see the bacteria. So a lot of what I do is, when I'm in schools, is very visual. It's looking at photographs and trying to get historical context. So I do the principles of historical thinking, which is, what is the source? What is the context? Can you corroborate your information? And really close reading is the other thing, to really look closely at where the document or the photograph, how, or the illustration, when it was created, who created, and what was their purpose.
Do you travel a lot as part of your research?
I travel as part of my research when I can. I was able to go to London. Right now, I'm working on a book on D-Day, and I probably I will travel to the Cornelius Ryan Collection in Ohio when I'm there for a school visit. I probably won't get to Normandy, and it's a very strange thing, but I actually find it more important even to travel when I'm writing historical fiction, because I have to sort of let my characters loose, say, in London, and they have to walk from one place to another. So for my book that came out last year, A Bandit's Tale, which is set in New York City, I dragged my daughter with me on a research trip to go to different parts in the story. Whereas in nonfiction, really what you're looking for, say for my D-Day book, are memoirs or recollections or first-person accounts that were as close to the time period as possible. Because after 50 or 60 years, memories fade and things become stories, they're not as vivid. And I had the chance to hear Rick Atkinson, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his World War II books. And he said very much the same thing, like the closer that you can get to the event with a first-person account, the better. So that's sort of the way I operate.
It's interesting. So how do you go about your process? I was going to ask you about your style, but also when you research, I mean, where do you even start when something comes along, and what's the typical length of the process? Is there similarity between books?
That's a good question. Well, I guess it depends whether it's a long book or a short book. I used to have a full-time job up until 3 years ago. I was in fundraising and grant writing in higher education. And so there I would spend a lot of my weekends. So I tend not to think of projects in terms of months or weeks, but more in terms of, like, hours. So, for instance, Dive, and What I Will Do, which was nonfiction about the war in the Pacific after World War II, after Pearl Harbor, and stories of submarines. I basically get as many books as I can, start reading about it and researching, and then I really try to select. There were many submarines. You know, it's kind of, sort of like Titanic. I could have written a whole other Titanic book with different people. Hmm. And what I like to do is choose people who lived through an event whose account is vivid enough to give, especially young readers, I think, a sense of what it was like to be there. And that's important to me. So I think as adults we can read history and we have maybe a higher tolerance for having lots of people's names that might be quoted with just one sentence, say in the Battle of D-Day. But what I'm looking for when I'm sort of doing my initial pass is to try to find people whose personalities come through to become in some ways characters in the book.
So someone that kids can latch onto, it sounds like.
Right. And so every book, especially a longer nonfiction book, then has, or with Steamboat School, even a picture book, you know, it has that challenge of whether your sources, again, going back to sources, whether your sources can, are sufficient for a work of nonfiction. And I've taught a nonfiction workshop at Highlights Foundation the last couple of years, and that was really a lot of what the participants who are aspiring writers, or in some cases published writers, the challenge of writing nonfiction is whether you have enough sources to create a sort of a page-turning narrative.
Now, so the next book will be on D-Day. Are there other topics that you're eyeing I didn't know if you'd want to talk about some of that?
Well, I have two spring picture books that are totally different. One is called A Letter to My Teacher, illustrated by Nancy Carpenter, which is contemporary, just about the relationship between a second grader and her teacher. And the other one is called Independence Cake, and it's it's historical fiction, and it's very clearly, it's about Amelia Simmons, but it's called A Revolutionary Confection, based on the life of Amelia Simmons, whose true history is unfortunately unknown. So again, there I wanted to play really with the fact that we don't know much about her, and to really introduce that idea that I'm making up a story here.
So, I hope that people look for those books. So, and the D-Day title book is what?
It's called D-Day, The Invasion That Changed History, and that should be out in fall 2018.
Great. Well, Deborah, thank you for talking to me. Deborah Hopkinson is the author of more than 40 books for children. She's won many awards for her books, and her newest book is called The Steamboat School. It's published by Hyperion, and the illustrator for the book is Ron Husband. Deborah, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks again, Susan.